how you work with students and families on college preparation.
So I typically start working with students and families in their students' junior year. We begin the process really by taking a look at a student's coursework, their grades, and begin planning for standardized tests and also making sure that they're in the appropriate classes. I think a lot of times students may end up for one reason or another in a class that could be too difficult for them or not challenging enough for them. So that's sort of where we start. We go through the full gamut of things that colleges are looking at, anything from their grades and test scores to recommendations, extracurriculars, letters from outside coaches and employers to make sure that they have everything that they need when they're going through the college application process.
So how has that changed over the years in terms of, you know, what's important, what's useful, I mean, and your approach to the college preparation process?
I think there have been a few cycles of how the college application process has sort of changed over the past 20 years or so. About 20 years ago, it started to become increasingly more competitive to get into some of the very selective schools, and a lot of counselors, both private counselors and school counselors, were really pushing students to sort of be well-rounded, the idea of the well-rounded student,
right.
someone who excelled in sports and after extracurricular clubs and volunteering and in school, of course, academically. I think, though, in the past 7 to 10 years or so, schools have been starting to look for well-rounded student bodies. So they're looking for students who have had a broad range of experiences but have started already to excel in one or two in particular. So I tend to see a lot of students come in saying, I've done all of these different things and look how well-rounded I am. And yet they haven't really developed any sort of leadership or expertise or significant skills in any one of those things. And I think schools are now starting to look for students who have some skill or experience in smaller numbers so that they can build a more well-rounded student body as opposed to having a student body full of relatively well-rounded people.
So given that, you know, when you look at your work with these students and their families, how do you define success, Zach?
So, you know, I think a lot of it now is finding what a student is really interested in. Now, freshmen are probably not going to know exactly what they're interested in, and I always recommend that freshmen take a broad look at all the things that their school and communities have to offer. And then starting in their sophomore year, start to figure out what are the things that I actually like doing. And those are the things to start to pursue a little bit more strategically, spending a little bit more time with those, weeding out some of the other things that have become superfluous and just you think you need it because of your resume. I really recommend that students don't do a whole host of activities just because they think they look good for college. They should be doing things that they love and that they enjoy doing. Now, they need to start developing some leadership and skill in those things so that they can show that they've dedicated some time and energy to developing that interest. But it certainly, you don't need to be a student who is, you know, on student newspaper and student council, volunteering at four different places, having three jobs, you know, spending your summers in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, you've never really developed an interest or a passion in any of those things.
Right.
You know, I talk to a lot of parents, especially of young men who are interested, let's say, in playing video games, right? And the parents are very concerned that they won't get into college because all they like to do is play video games. Well, it's a very legitimate
interest that they have, and I think it can absolutely be explored. I once had a student who was so into video games, and when I started working with him and his family, I recommended, hey, you know, do you play these games competitively? And he was a very big first-person shooter game, and he did play competitively, and I asked if he had friends who played, and he said, yeah, they all played sort of from their homes. And I said, why don't you get people together to play these games? 2.5 years later, he's running a county-wide competition at his school to see who's the best player in one of these first-person shooter games. Now, that's absolutely showing the initiative that and leadership that colleges are looking for, but it's in an area that the student was actually passionate about. It's certainly non-traditional, especially, you know, from the parents' perspective. They were very worried about this.
Right.
And he did very well and developed all the skills that you could get by being the editor of your newspaper or being your class president.
Yeah, cool. So, again, given your experience, and you start with a pool of students and families, you know, how many should go to college, how many should do something else? What's your sense of that?
So that's tough. I definitely have a skewed view of the high school graduates. Most students that I work with are already on track for a four-year institution. That is not to say that necessarily everybody is. I have worked with a variety of families at different points, some whose students haven't yet demonstrated that they have matured enough or developed enough to be sent off to a four-year institution on their own. And so some families opt to send their child to a two-year institution or stay local with the idea that, you know, prove yourself, and then we will help you financially and emotionally go away to finish your degree. I've also worked with a number of families where the students are average academically, but they're certainly not average people, and they go through the college process, they look for some of the schools that they think that they'll be happy in, and all of a sudden, in their sophomore or junior year at college, they really find themselves. They become social, they start to actually focus in on their academics and perform well, they start to figure out what their interests are career-wise. Every student is really going to mature and develop at a different rate, and not everyone is ready at 18 to necessarily go off to a four-year institution, and some go off blindly and develop quite a bit from there. And so I think, you know, it's a very case-by-case basis, and I wouldn't be able to give you a percentage of, you know, who should go and who shouldn't go and who should do a two-year option to start, but they're all options that are available.
What have you had many students who came up through either homeschooling or online schools, and, you know, what? How does that play out?
You know, I've only worked with a handful of homeschooled students who I guess you would consider online students, because once they got to high school, they were really sort of maxed out the capacity that a parent or a caregiver was able to help them. And they started to transition to things like the Florida Virtual School or Aventa classes to finish their high school degrees. It's sort of the same thing. It's you know, that you have to succeed academically, especially for selective colleges. You have to do well on the tests if the colleges take the test. There are a handful of schools that now don't require it, and you have to find some things to do outside of the classroom. It's very similar. It's just a very different setting in terms of where they are. It's actually a little bit more difficult for them to find outside opportunities. Now, homeschools and online students tend to have jobs or internships more often than students who are in school, because they have much more of a flexible schedule. So they're getting a lot more life experience or work experience, which I think colleges are actually starting to value more and more. And so it's a little bit of a different experience, but again, it's the same process for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you seeing, the cost of the game, you know, obviously keeps going up. I mean, what What are you seeing with your parents and families there? Is it a movement back to certain public schools, or are they absorbing the costs, or how's that playing out?
So it's a very difficult conversation, and I try to put all of the information out on the table for families. It's a very personal and strategic decision that they have to make. I do see a lot of families, especially in Madison, who you know, the goal is to have their son or daughter go to University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not necessarily the best school for every student.
Right.
It's a great institution academically and socially, and it's very well known, but not everyone thrives in such a large environment, an urban environment, and there are other options for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to make sure that a student's also being academically challenged, and so sometimes parents, because of costs, will start to look at other schools that are whose sticker price is low. So looking at some of the other state schools, or looking at other schools that have low sticker prices, but may not be academically challenging enough for their child.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I work with those families on is really taking a look at other schools, perhaps private schools, where the sticker price may be high, but between financial aid and merit aid, they're going to be able to almost match what the University of Wisconsin at Madison is going to charge.
Hmm.
A great example of this is Miami University in Oxford, Ohio.
Right.
You get a certain number on your ACT, and they're going to give you somewhere near $20,000 a year.
Right.
And it's a great option. If you're academically talented, private schools are going to give out money. So what I recommend to families to do is as of October of last year, there's something called net price calculators. So every college in the country is now required to have on their website something called a net price calculator. A family can put in information about their income, their assets, and out returns, what the school, an estimate of what the school would actually charge you out of pocket,
mm-hmm.
what loans you should take out or will have to take out, what grant money you're going to be offered. Some of these calculators are very accurate, some are a little less so, some involve a lot more information, and some are a bit more superficial. But it gives you at least a sense of, you know, the sticker price is not always what it actually costs to go to school there. And that's from a financial aid perspective, a need-based aid perspective. There's something else, the common data set, which is what U.S. News and the College Board use to get information about schools and then rank schools. Each school actually on their websites will publish their common data set. And within the common data set, there's a section for aid. They will describe how much money they gave out, how much of it was federal money, how much of it was institutional money, and how much went to students who demonstrated need, and how much of it went to students who earned it through merit. And so I think a lot of families who are sort of on the cusp, we talk about middle class, I'm not exactly sure where that's defined, but middle class families who don't necessarily qualify for federal financial aid, but to pay sticker price would be out of their budget. There are a lot of schools that will give out money to students who are academically talented, and the Common Data Set is a great way to take a look at least how generous a school is with those types of students.
Do you have a sense of when you look at all these different colleges and the schools you work with for these students, do you have a sense of the range of costs, the real cost? It's interesting to me when I look at this to see what, you know, there's the advertised price, and you cited, you know, Miami of Ohio is one great example, and you know, they all have this price on their website, and, you know, so would you say in general that across all the students who go to these schools that, you know, the net price maybe is 20% of that, or I'm sorry, 80% of that, or 60% of that, or, you know, what do you think the real price of higher education is these days?
Well, it's tough. Obviously, a big factor in that is going to be the parents' income and assets. And
right.
So that's a tough call. So let's take the example of a parent qualifies for no need-based aid.
Mm-hmm.
And what I typically see happen is if you take a student who attends a school that is what I would consider sort of a half step down academically from what their range is, they're looking at cutting the tuition cost in half.
Okay.
So that, you know, housing and all that, all the incidentals are still there. But the tuition, if you were to take a half step sort of down, would be half of what the sticker price is, because a lot of these schools are very generous. They're very interested and motivated in getting students who are above their average academic student to their school for either good reasons or rankings reasons, and they have large endowments to do this.
Did I lose you? Oh, no.
No, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes. So,
okay, sorry.
Yeah, you were saying, so they have large endowments, and so essentially half.
And they have the capacity to fund their their institutional priorities, and one of them may be to attract more academically qualified students. Looking at sort of at a GPA and the level of rigor of their coursework and standardized test scores.
Well, that's actually a reasonably optimistic outlook then for, you know, keeping it somewhat affordable, I guess.
And you know what? The other piece of it is, you know, students should have a stake in the game.
Yes.
There is an appropriate amount of debt that a student can take out to fund their own education. I think it's very appropriate for the student to feel like I have a financial stake in this. What I typically recommend, and this is not my recommendation per se, but it comes from a variety of sources that say, look at the average starting salary of a graduate from that institution, and that amount is approximately what you could take out in loans as a student. So at UW-Madison, the average graduate earns about $41,000 a year. So it would be appropriate for a student to take out about $41,000 in loans to finance his or her education there. It's an interesting and I think a good proxy for figuring out what the debt could be. I also think it's good for students to have this financial stake because it encourages them to finish on time. We know that almost 50% of in-state students at UW-Madison don't finish in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Taking that fifth year, basically, is going to cost you somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000 between tuition, housing, and incidentals, and lost wages.
Lost wages, right.
And if you were to apply that to a private school, you're now paying about the same price as a private school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you got out of the private school in 4 years.
Right. Interesting. Are you seeing a change in, you know, where, let's say, Madison area kids are going? I mean, or is it sort of the same, you know, you identify the UW and then there's a variety of other schools, you know, are the paths all similar or anything new?
You know, I think you definitely have a diverse group of people here in Madison. You have a lot of transplants from other parts of the country who are typically more willing to take a look at a broader geographic range of schools. You know, if a family comes from the East or West Coast, they're okay with sending their child to the East or West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But families that are Midwest sort of centric sometimes set a geographic boundary around Madison. Maybe it's 6 hours or so, 6 hours driving time, so they can include some of the schools here at the Twin Cities. The issue with these geographic boundaries, though, is that schools are pretty spread out here in Wisconsin and in Illinois and in Minnesota, and Iowa. There isn't the density of colleges that you find in a place like Ohio, even.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times I encourage families to say, or to at least look and see what are you cutting off by setting this relatively artificial boundary geography-wise, and start taking a look at schools that may be in Ohio or in Indiana or in Michigan. And I understand that there are potentially added costs if you have to fly to a school. There is some level of comfort that parents take in having their kids be a drive away, and I get that. But I think it's worth considering, what are you taking out of the equation because you set this boundary, and then being thoughtful and saying, I'm comfortable with taking these out of the equation.
Mm-hmm. How about students' majors over the arc of your experience? You know, are you seeing something new, or, you know, you gave this example of the video game, you know, the video game thing, and I mean, are students still pursuing hard sciences or liberal arts or business, or, you know, what's the range of what they're thinking about doing and actually doing?
It's all over the board. You still see a lot of students who are business majors or some variant thereof. A lot of students who are looking at psychology or something similar. But I would say most of my students, I haven't run the numbers on it, but I think more than half of the students I've worked with have changed their major at least once. Hmm. And that's fairly consistent with some of the national statistics. A lot of students go to school thinking they are going to be interested or do one particular field, and then they change their mind, which is, I think, normal and appropriate and part of maturing and growing up. So how does this affect the college application process? I think that when students, families, or parents box the student in to a major, sometimes they start looking at schools that either excel in that field or you know, they have a very strong program in that field, but not necessarily in other fields. And so I often see a lot of students who say, I really want to go to school X because they have this great program in the field I'm interested in. And then when I ask them, well, what happens if you decide you don't want to pursue that field? Would you be comfortable at that school in a different field? And a lot of times they actually answer no, which I think is very interesting, because they were putting a lot of faith that they were going to become a veterinarian, and they were going into a pre-vet program at a school that had a very good pre-vet program, but didn't realize that, oh, I could be a biology major at another school or that could get me to become a veterinarian. And if I decided I didn't want to be a biology major or a veterinarian, I could major in medieval literature.
Right.
So, you know, I think. Look, you have to find a school that at least has the field that you're interested in. If you're interested in architecture, you shouldn't go to a school that doesn't have something that could lead to a career in architecture. Mm-hmm. But should you go to a school that you otherwise wouldn't have gone to because you think they have a great architecture program, I'm not sure, given the number of students who change their minds when they are in college. Hmm.
Is there much competition with what you do? I mean, obviously you have a website, your you know, social media and all that. I mean, tell me how, you know, when you start talking with students and parents, you know, are there a lot of other people? Is it difficult? Is it a, you know, decent market? What's the business like?
You know, I think there are a couple of other people in the Madison area who do this. I think a lot of a few of them focus more on the financial aid side of it. I am not a financial planner, but there are financial planners who I think probably do a great job of helping you with that component of it. This may be a relatively new thing here in Madison, because the university in Madison has become so competitive to get into now that there's sort of this need to help look at a broader range of schools, both geographically and academically, that maybe hasn't existed here before. If you were to go to the coast, or you go to even a place like Chicago, you're going to see private college counselors show up fairly often, and it's actually pretty common for families to hire someone to help them through the process, because this is a major decision. You're about to invest what could be between $100,000 and $250,000, and in your child, and in their education and their future, and a lot of families would like to have somebody help them through the process. Now, can you go through the process on your own? Sure. Families do it all the time, and they are very successful at it. But some families just want an additional guide or support or someone to bounce questions off of, and then also someone to help their child through the nuts and bolts of the process, which has become increasingly complex and competitive. So there are a few other people in Madison who do this. I think, you know, it's much more common in on the coast. And I think, you know, as we see schools' budgets get cut and support staff get cut, there is, a greater need for additional services to be provided outside of school, because caseloads for school counselors has become enormous and so varied that their focus may not necessarily be on selected four-year institutions or helping a family navigate the college application process when they have different priorities or even just incredibly large caseloads. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. So now thinking about the future, there's Coursera, there's Udacity, there's a number of online higher ed plays that are pure online. I almost refer to them as synthetic, where they're trying to weave together, obviously what they consider to be the best of the best, right? You know, you do this, you can have courses from MIT, Berkeley, the whole deal. How is that going to play out? Is it going to be effective in the next 10 years, or is it just a... it'll end up on the rocks. What's your sense?
It is very exciting to see the developments that occur, and the big step is going to be when somebody confers a degree based on these courses. Mm-hmm. Right now, you've got the bunch that you mentioned that offer online courses. Some are starting to offer credit for them if you do some very complex, apply your credit to one thing, which then you have to then transfer to another thing, and maybe you can patchwork it all together into a degree. But there's still a big emphasis attached with having a degree from a particular name brand institution, and until those name brands start to accept these online courses and perhaps put them together into a traditional program that gets you a degree, they're going to generate a lot of traction, not with your traditional 18 to 24-year-old students. Mm-hmm. Who are looking for that residential experience and also a degree from the institution. So I think they're having an enormous effect on non-traditional students, adults going back to school, people looking to finish their degree who had a bunch of coursework. But again, for your traditional 18 to 24-year-olds, there's going to be a market for the residential college experience, which may be hybrid and have some online coursework involved. But again, if you can't get your degree from MIT online, then these courses are not going to change the landscape.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that when they step over the credential line with something that has meaning, I think that's going to be the moment. And my own guess, and this is simply a guess or a theory, is that the way they'll do it is, given their pedigrees in amongst the financial community and obviously the tech community, I think they will cut deals with some of the big companies and say, you can invest in our deal, but then you have to hire X number of our students. And I think that will be the moment that it becomes a big deal, because they will have another out. You say, all right, you go through this for 4 years or 2 years or 3 years, and we're going to guarantee you a job if you do A, B, C, D. I think that will be the killer app, let's say, of these guys, frankly.
Yeah.
Especially with name companies.
And you're going to have to see a big name do it.
Right, exactly.
You've got a lot of these private liberal arts traditional residential undergrad schools who are doing a lot of online coursework themselves to generate revenues because they don't have big endowments.
Yep.
And you know, that is still not the popular way of going about it for 18 to 24-year-olds. And so another thing is that I think there will always be a market for the residential experience.
Yes.
There is a lot to be gained by going off to college in a traditional sense. And so, you know, if that's what all of the top most competitive students are doing, it will continue to have an effect on the rest of the market in that students who are academically average are still going to want to mimic that experience at a traditional school. But if you see a school like Brown or Harvard or MIT or even Stanford come out and say, we are offering a full online degree, this is the cost, this is how you can put your classes together, and it doesn't come attached with the stigma of being online, you get it, you got it. Mm-hmm. You will see some change, but you will still have students who want to go and spend their 4 years there.
Yeah, I agree. I have two last questions for you, Zach. One is, if you were, we jumped into the time machine and you were 18 or 17 today, what would you study? What would you do?
I started in a very quantitative major when I was an undergrad, and then I moved into a more people-centric major. If I were to go back, I would definitely stick with my quantitative background. I think there are, if you enjoy numbers, if you have a knack for them, there are a lot of different places where you can apply a quantitative background and be very happy. And I think, you know, I sort of came in late to the game to education. I decided late in college that I was passionate about education and working with adolescent students. And you can do that still with a quantitative background. You can do almost anything with it. So if I were to go back, I'd probably either continue as a math major or become an engineering major, so I could build a sort of a number skill.
Yeah, hard science. Okay, then last question. So, you know, you're talking to a parent of a child in, let's say, elementary school, you know, third, fourth, fifth grade. You know, what do you tell them, thinking ahead to their college days and their post, you know, higher ed days, whatever that looks like? What do you tell them today?
Save your money.
work
with a financial planner to make sure that you're saving appropriately. I know that if you were to extrapolate and make projections for 10 or 15 years from now, it probably will seem incredibly ridiculous the amount that the sticker prices will be.
It's ugly.
But that's first, obviously, is for the parents to do, and then there's, you know, for a third or fourth grader or someone in elementary school, it's really helping them to love to learn. That, you know, colleges are looking for students first and foremost. They want students who you know, have excelled academically in one areas or one area or multiple areas, and to really help facilitate that love of learning. I think you know, a lot of emphasis sometimes for families is on athletics, which is great. When they're, especially in elementary school, but you still want to support what's going on inside the classroom, whether it's, you know, reading with your kid or having him or her read to you, doing the math homework with them, trying to help make some of the concepts fun, explore, do little science experiments in your house, you know, any way that you can encourage them to continue to learn and to read and to work with numbers is obviously going to be helpful for college. So I don't think you need to be having them write their personal essay when they're 8 or 9 years old or even start any sort of clubs at that age, but definitely you need to get them on the path to loving to learn.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Zach. Anything else you want to add before we go? I appreciate it very much.
You know, the one thing that didn't come up that I do want to put in is the idea of employment. Mm-hmm. Because this is actually a relatively new trend that I think colleges are starting to really like to see students who have entry-level employment experience.
Yes.
Which I think is different. So you had a lot of parents pushing kids 10 years ago to become the captain of a team or to become the president of a club, and schools, colleges have now realized that that's what everyone wants and tries to do. But there's a lot gained from having an entry-level experience, whether it's being a bagger at a grocery store or a cashier at a retail store or serving in a restaurant. Those entry-level experiences are going to give you a lot of credibility with working with a diverse group of people, dealing with customers, having a boss, doing some of the grunt work that's involved in it, you know, not being too good for some of that type of work. So, you know, I just wanted to add that in there, that I think, you know, work is a great experience for college and college applications. It also is very helpful for families to have that little bit of extra income, and it's helpful for students to be supporting their recreational activities. If they want to go to the movies, they can work and earn some money to do that.
Exactly. So just to follow up on that, when you think about the cost of college, you know, and obviously there's parent money, family money, and then there's borrowing, you know, what percentage, you know, do you recommend that students work and contribute to that?
Again, it's going to be very, very specific to each family. Mm-hmm. I think students should help out a reasonable amount. I think that, you know, above and beyond basic housing and food costs should really be on the student, so that they can start to learn to budget their money and to earn some of it as well, whether it's through a summer job or a part-time job during the year. I think, you know, there's a big push, especially in high schools, on learning about budgeting and personal finance. I think if you come out of college and you haven't had that experience yet, the real world's going to hit you pretty hard.
yes.
And you know, things add up, and I think it's important for students, especially in college, to start to realize this. Their first time living on their own, and of course parents want to help them. But there is a level of help that's too much and doesn't help students learn what the value of a dollar is and also how to manage their money.
Yeah. Well, great. Again, it's been an informative chat, Zach, and I appreciate your time. I'm going to stop recording now. Let's see.